Okay, welcome. This is a practical workshop in diffusion of innovations featuring speaker Stephen Arid Sheriffs. He's an associate university registrar at Stanford University. Welcome especially to the online audience. Feel free to enter any questions and participate by using the media site that you've got. And of course, anyone in the room who has questions, we do ask that you use the microphone so that our online participants can be part of the process. Take it away.
All right, thanks very much, Sherry. So this is a practical workshop in diffusion of innovation. I'd like to ask anybody who's online, could you pop a quick note to Sherry and just let us know who's there? Because we are going to try and involve you. We're going to have some online resources a little bit later. So I thought I'd start by introducing myself. Thank you very much, Sherry. By way of broad introduction, I've lived a lot of different lives over the course of my career, from types editor to academic. And now I manage technological innovation for the Registrar's Office at Stanford University. Most of what I do relates to staff and faculty. Occasionally, student things fall on my plate. But we find that students tend to be really good early adopters, and we don't have to do that much. We just have to point them in that direction. We've got some laggards. I'll be talking about laggards a little later. I'd like to note, whenever I talk about my position, that the difference between a bunch of people sitting around in a pub talking about stuff in a university is a registrar. The registrar was the first officer of the university because we kept the record of what happened. And that was an innovation. And it might be interesting to note how that innovation traveled through time and history and who resisted it and who adopted it. But of course, that's not exactly what we're doing here. So note that the first innovators in university life were registrars. We'd like to say that. So who are you? Why don't we just shout out where you're from, names? Go ahead. Just.
Online, we have Michelle from Southern Utah University. Saying hi.
Hi, Michelle. And hey, who are you guys just coming in?
I'm Alana Spelly, and I'm from New Mexico State University.
And? Yeah, we'll probably combine you all when time comes. Okay, great. So we got a lot of people from a lot of places. So what are we going to do here today? I'm going to talk a little bit about some ideas. And then we're going to have two separate breakout sessions. And I'll explain those as we go along. I've got a bunch of different resources. I don't know if anybody, did anybody have a look at my little website? I've developed it a little further since then. The way that I work, as you're going to see, is I like images. I was wandering around the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk on a rather cold day in December, and I was thinking about this presentation. And somehow I thought the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk looked like diffusion of innovation. So that explains a bunch of these slides. What we're doing here today is a bit of an experiment. So I brought along Albert Einstein. this Albert lives on the computer of an 87-year-old friend of mine who is the chief cataloger, the head cataloger at the University of California at Berkeley for many years. When he arrived in that job in 1971, the first thing he said to his boss was, he tells this story again and again and again. Those of you who care for 87-year-olds know that the stories get repeated. You know, this card catalog, it's going away. It's all going to be on computers sooner or later. And they responded by reducing his responsibilities. But he was a disruptor. He was always a disruptor. And he's a good friend of mine. He wanted me to bring Albert Einstein. Because if we're going to experiment a little bit, we have to be in the guise of mad scientists. And I think part of innovation is always being in the guise of being a mad scientist. We're trying to do things. We're trying to do things that are different. We're trying to break the mold. We don't want to be too silly. But we're going to be mad scientists, because the mad scientists can break the rules. So we're going to try to have fun a little later. I hope I don't overwhelm you with too many of these thoughts, but all of the key words I put on later slides that I'll put up that you can contemplate as we do our exercises. Another set of characters that I like to think about are, this is Augustus and Queen Boadicea, or Boudica, depending on how you pronounce it. These are folks who started out low and went high. Now, of course, Queen Boudica lost, Augustus won. But both of them started out with an idea. They had an audience. They had time. They tried to get other people to pick up that idea. They tried to create change agents and opinion leaders. They're models for us. I think people, when they think of Augustus, I'm a history buff. When they think of Augustus, sometimes they think of him as Augustus. When he started out, he was Octavian, and nobody, not a soul in Rome, would have bet on him winning after Caesar died. But he did. And that's because he strategized. Because I think one of the things we don't do enough of is strategize in our diffusion of innovation, and strategize based upon what the key areas of uncertainty are. Because innovation is about uncertainty. A lot of what I've done here today is based on the seminal work of Everett Rogers in his Diffusion of Innovation's fifth edition. And many of you probably, I wanted to say this a little earlier, I imagine there are people in this room who know a lot more about this than I do. And I'm hoping you bring your voices forward in the interactive part of this. But what he writes about uncertainty is the degree to which a number of alternatives are perceived with respect to the occurrence of an event and the relative probability of alternatives. Uncertainty implies a lack of predictability, of structure, of information. So the job of strategy in diffusion of innovations is to reduce uncertainty by increasing information, predictability, and structure. So I'll have these terms on later slides. That's what we're thinking about when we talk about diffusion of innovation. Now, another definition of diffusion of innovation is that it is a social process where subjectively perceived information about a new idea is communicated from person to person. So I'm going to structure what I'm going to say about diffusion of innovation into these five broad areas. But just because we're disruptors, I'm not going to do it in order. We'll start with communication. It's all about communication. We talk a lot about communication. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I do want us to keep in mind that in thinking of communication, there are various channels with various audiences, because communication is our toolkit. There's different kinds of communication. There's media channels. There's interpersonal channels. There's meetings. There's papers. There's all sorts of different ways to communicate. But the important part of communication is lining it up to an audience, and lining it up to an audience that we understand. We're going to talk about audience a little bit later. But communication is the process by which participants, and that involves both the innovators and the diffusers of innovation and the audience, create and share information. So it is a lot about audience. I cannot remember a presentation which I didn't use this slide, because I think you always have to think about audience. And we have to look at audiences, again, in terms of their uncertainties and what information, structure, and predictability will influence them, because diffusion of innovation is about social change. Okay, so now it's a new idea. What is the difference between a new idea and an innovation? How does it rise to the level of innovation? There are a lot of new ideas, but an innovation has certain characteristics, and again, we're relying on the work of Everett Rogers, and we'll keep these things in mind later. It has a relative advantage over what went before. It has some kind of compatibility, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's comfortable. It just means it fits something. Probably, in our case, it fits change. It fits change in business practices, it fits social change. Most innovations have complexity. They also have trialability. You can try them. You can work on them. You can do a user experience testing. We know a lot about this. And last but not least, it has observability. People are going to notice it, and they're going to change because of it. The key thing that, I guess I cut that slide out, sorry, accidentally. So the thing that we have to note is that innovations which have relative advantage and compatibility, trialability, and observability, and less complexity are more readily sped to adoption. So one of the things we want to do is we want to keep control of that complexity and the message around complexity that we deliver. So this is, of course, Louis Armstrong, and it's also from, and he was filled with new ideas, and it's also from the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk. Somehow, you know what I've done? I've somehow managed to mess up my slides at the last minute. Oh yeah, sorry, so my apologies. The other thing, and this may seem a little contradictory, especially to the idea of compatibility, and this I took from an article in Education Week that quoted a blog post from Jim Shelton. Does anybody know Jim Shelton? And he wrote that an innovation has to shatter the performance expectations of today's status quo. Remember, we're being disruptive. All right, so now we're back on track. Diffusion of innovation is a social process. Earlier we talked about audience, we saw a happy face and a sad face, comedy and tragedy, but that's not adequate for us. Rogers describes five audiences. He talks about innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. So to me, I like to put the innovators and the early adopters together, and I like to put the early and late majority together, and the laggards off to the side. And so this is the slide I came up with to illustrate our three populations. Now, it happens to dovetail with the fact that I love mustard. I use ketchup when that's all there is, and I wouldn't put relish on a hot dog if it was the only condiment within miles. So unfortunately, mustard is going to be our early adopters, ketchup is going to be our middle, and relish is going to be our laggards. So early adopters. You know, early adopters are our friends. They're the people that we share attitudes with, we share values. They have the same kinds of thoughts. We probably know them well. We probably go to lunch with them. So it's great when they like us, but it's kind of like mom liking you. It actually doesn't get you very far. And one of the dangers in strategizing diffusion of innovation is to rely too much upon what your early adopters say. You certainly want them to get out there and get the message out there. They'll do a lot of good work for you. If you give them their talking points, they'll do them. They're going to be friends. They're going to be allies. But just because you convince them doesn't mean you've really done anything. You've only just begun. But the equal and opposite danger is to pay too much attention to laggards. These are the people who relish failure, who see the bad in everything, who wouldn't take a free trip to the candy store if you offered it them in a gold envelope. Now, we love to tell about them, and techies, we all have to admit, we love our war stories about our laggards. We've all got them, we tell them, we sit around coffee, and say, you have no idea what so-and-so just did. But the key point here is that if you base your strategy on laggards, and I have to say, coming from a registrar background, there's a tendency to do this. This is, registrars, we don't see anybody except our laggards. Everybody else who adopts the system, they're just off they go. It's our laggards that we see. Those are our pain points. We tend to think about them a lot. My advice is, in diffusion of innovation, forget the laggards. Smile at them, pat them on the back, give them the same materials, provide them with the help system, but don't base your strategy on them, because the key people are the ones in the middle. Now, I'm going to describe a couple things about them. They neither love us nor hate us. They neither nod their heads up and down nor wag their heads back and forth. These are the folks where the action is, and they're quite often very quiet. They quite often don't have a lot to say. You quite often don't even, it depends on your milieu, and I'm going to hope that we've got a bunch of different milieus in which we're diffusing innovation here. But they're quite often very silent. I was much attracted to an idea of a sociologist long retired, I think he was at Stanford at the end of his career, Mark Granovetter, called The Strength of Weak Ties. And in this, he talked that there was a lot of research done in the idea of weak ties based on job searches. And it turns out, well, first of all, I want to say that strong ties are very easy to understand. Okay, we know our strong ties. And where there's no tie at all, we can understand that. But weak ties are a little more complex. And as I was about to say, that in the area of job search, it turned out that better results were achieved by job searchers through people with whom they had weak ties than with people they had with strong ties, because people with weak ties knew things that they didn't know. The people with whom you have strong ties, they tend to have the same knowledge set as you. They tend to have the same expectations. They know the same people. They go to the same bars. All right? They eat the same kind of food, whatever you want. I'm going too far afield there. But this is important to understand how to leverage weak ties. So in our exercise today, we are going to look at the nature of the strength of weak ties that you have with the middle folks in your populations and how we make them into strong ties. So back to basic principles, we need to alleviate the uncertainties of this population through information, predictability, and structure. And predictability is something that can flow from those values and attitudes which we share. And again, I'm restricting it not to values in the wider sense, but to the values we share about our work or about the arena in which we live. It turns out that one weak tie, and again, this comes from the research, that is especially strong is the perception of competence. And that's something that, by and large, IT departments, notwithstanding all the complaining, have in large amounts. So it's something to think about. What are the competences in this area that you can try and translate into that area? It might be noted that competence is congruent with predictability. So when we look at weak ties, we want to look for competence and shared values and experiences. Okay, so the real strength of weak ties is in understanding how a message can travel further and traverse greater through distance, greater in distance, in social distance through people with whom you have weak ties. In other words, when I talk to a friend, he or she's likely to talk to another friend. But when I talk to someone with whom I have a weak tie, that person is likely to talk to somebody I don't know, or somebody who might, or somebody with further down the road. So leveraging those people, turning them into your opinion leaders, into your change agents, that's a key strategy for speeding diffusion of innovation. Now, one of the problems about this is we don't control it. We talk a lot about viral communication, but of course, once the message is out, you don't necessarily, your friends, you can always correct. The people in the middle, you can't necessarily correct as well, and that becomes a bit of a problem. And so you want to try and control your message. We'll talk about that by looking at how we propagate diffusion of innovation from person to person. Now, again, I'm going to go to something that, a chart that comes out of Everett Rogers. He likes nouns, I like verbs. So I put it into verbs. First thing you have to do, you have to know, you have to have knowledge. Then you have to persuade. The third step is to get a decision. The fourth step is implementation. And the fifth step is confirmation. Now, knowledge, we have the knowledge. But the problem for me, oh, I see, I did this wrong. Sorry. in persuasion is about involvement. In other words, when we try to persuade people, there's a certain negative characteristic there. It's like you're trying to sell them something. I think we need to think of persuasion in terms of involvement. And by leveraging involvement, by getting those that middle rank involved early in the process, they might say things to you that are going to be disruptive. Scope creep is good. Keep that in mind. If you're a diffuser of innovation, if you're an application developer, I know it's terrifying. But if you're a diffuser of innovation, scope creep is good. Talk to people about version 2. I make a list right away. Okay, that's not that's not in this version, but let's keep this list for version 2. And then you can make that list public and tell people, this is what we're thinking about for version 2. Which ones do you think are more important? So decide, implement, confirm, and I'm very sorry to say that I obviously didn't think these slides through quite correctly, because when we get to the fifth part, confirm, I'd like to change that to reinvent. And this, again, is an idea from Everett Rogers that I think is really important. Are your adopters your partners in innovation or your clients? If you can make them your partners, what does that do to your strategy? How does it change your strategy if those that middle rank are your partners? Higher degrees of reinvention typically lead to a higher degree of sustainability of the innovation over time. So, again, I think that's a key and important idea, because you want to engage them as mad scientists too. You don't know who they're going to be, who those thought leaders are going to be, who those opinion leaders, who those change agents are going to be. You can find them in the most unlikely places. Again, it's about uncertainty. We have continuous leaders, and we have to be continuous leaders and rebels, because when confronted with something they don't know, people will tend to retreat into their uncertainties. So again, the job of strategy and diffusion of innovations is to reduce uncertainty by increasing predictability and structure and innovation, by being mad scientists. So the last of our five categories is subjectively perceived information. And we know that this is a difficult problem, because people do not always hear what we say in every venue of human communication. How do we craft a message which will at least not suffer in translation and at best provide a platform for articulation by the very opinion leaders whom we're trying to create? There are a couple of aspects of subjectively perceived information. First of all, as I said, we don't control it. And secondly, it is itself an additional layer of uncertainty. So here we are trying to reduce uncertainty, and we're adding an uncertainty to it by the very nature of what we're doing. So I was going to tell a long story. I'll just say this, that in a recent implementation that I did, I decided, you know what, these people, they always want a PDF. I'm not giving them a PDF. I made a the vendor had a beautiful website, but it didn't have the word Stanford on it. And some of the people I work with, if it doesn't say Stanford, they won't do it. So what happened was the dean of H&S office of Humanities and Science actually made a PDF. And halfway through the middle of it, I decided to co-opt it, take all the material, put it on the web. They wrote it. It turned out they wrote it really well because it was from their point of view. And I ended up with a beautiful website that said the same thing as the vendor's website, but organized in the way that my users wanted it to use. I've now made a deal with the dean of H&S, and they're going to write a lot of help material for me because after I speak it to them, because I've co-opted them into being my my change agents. So that's an example of that. One idea that we're a big champion of at Stanford is communities of practice. And a community of practice or a community of interest is a collaborative community based upon a specific domain of knowledge. If you get people involved and give them some sense of ownership, they will become your viral agents. Just for those of you who want to think more about this, we have a site, COP, communityofpractice.stanford.edu, with a lot of resources. A couple of those things are still hidden behind WebAuth, because we're trying to get a copyright release for some rather extensive quotes from the book that I quote on our website. So think about a community of practice as a mode of diffusion. One thing about leveraging those people is that mood is contagious. And remember that. An upbeat mood is contagious. Getting other people involved, they will spread that mood for you. So I was obviously getting punchy at this point. Don't grip the ball too tightly. And with that, we're on to diffusion of innovations exercise one. All right, so we have one person online. Is that correct? Oh, you have a couple? Who else is online?
We have Frank from UC Santa Cruz, home of the boardwalk, and then Michelle from Southern Utah University.
Oh, great.
The ones who've checked in.
Great, Frank. Sorry I stole all of your most famous landmarks in Santa Cruz there. So for those of you who have a computer at your table, you can go to studentaffairs.stanford.edu/registrar/staff/DOI. And there we're going to have a couple resources. There will be three ways that we can perform this exercise. So the first exercise is about audience. What we want is at each table, we want somebody to identify some diffusion of innovation, which you've been involved in, which you are going to be involved in, which you are involved in. You can change the names of the innocent to protect them. All right, you don't have to write down, you know, the dean of students said, no way. And I want you to answer these questions. Now, and I'll put this slide back up later. So all of these various terms that I've used, I've got down at the bottom. So the things that you want to organize. So let me just see on that page. Let's see if we go here. If you scroll down here, you can either do this in something called Lucid Chart. You're going to need a Google or Yahoo ID to log in. So if one of you could log in. What I've done is I've created, why are you doing that? It did this to me before. All right, let me go there. It should let you in right away.
And Barbara has also joined us from the University of Texas at San Antonio.
So this looks better. The resolution on this screen is a little small, but what I want you to do if you use this is to go to the middle one, and you can use this mind map, and all you do is you scroll down here to mind map, and you can grab things and talk about your audiences. This can be audience two. Here. And you can give them a characteristic. You know, characteristic two. So if you want to use that, feel free to use it. If some of you are kind of geeky and want to play with this Lucid Chart thing, I'm kind of hoping some of you do it. On exercise two, we're going to use this one that I created. Or you can just go to the blank page and do whatever you want. But what I want you to do is answer those questions. Talk about your middle group. We'll take about 15 minutes. Now, the other option on this, the link is also on that page, is you can go here. And I want each of you to call out what group. I made 8 of them, so everybody has a separate group. You can either do I just created a spreadsheet with the questions on it. You can answer them there. Then we can display them and talk about them. Or alternatively, if you're like me, or that's a Google Doc. If you're like me and you prefer a spreadsheet, you can answer them on the spreadsheet. Or if you prefer, assign somebody to be your note taker and use the big white piece of paper on the board. So those of you who are online, if you're in a group, you can do it together. If you're alone, you can do it yourself. Just pick one of those modes. So let's go and let's call this table 1. Now, there's only 2 of you, so why don't you join another table? So let's call this table 1. That's table 2, table 3, and table 4. So, and if you use, or you can use, I give everything a different number. So if you're going to use the Lucid chart, go to Lucid chart 1. Lucid chart 2, Lucid chart 3, Lucid chart 4, or if you use the Google chart 11, 12, 13, 14, or if you use the Google spreadsheet 21, 22, 23, 24. Okay? And how many people have we got there? 3. So give them each numbers 5, 6, and 7, or 15, 16, 17, or 25, 26, 27. I think I made that a little complicated. It's the last digit. Ignore the first digit, just the last digit.
So Barbara has 5, Frank has 6, and Michelle has 7?
Right.
Okay.
Okay, and if they're confused, they can write a note to you.
Or if you want to we'll use the Google. We'll be confused
together. If you want to use the Google Doc, go ahead and do it. So go ahead and let's get started. Yes. Oh, yes. It's Student Affairs. Unfortunately, the short form, for some reason, didn't work. Oh, here, let's do it this way. And where did I put it? Oh, yeah, and then it came up, right? There it is. studentaffairs.stanford.edu/registrar/staff/DOI. So feel free to just use the big white piece of paper in front of you. And if you want a different color, I've got some more over here. But if somebody wants to use that Lucid chart, I think it would be fun. And we can always use a Google Doc. So we'll take about, say, 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll come back together and look at what everybody's done. All right, folks, let's come back together and see what we've learned. Why don't we? Did anybody do the Lucid charts? Well, I did get a year's subscription out of the deal, the company, so I'm going to be able to play with it for a year. Here's a microphone. So let's start with table 1. And where did you use the Google Doc 11? Is that right?
Actually, we just ended up hand drawing.
Oh, okay.
Hand responding and discussing.
Okay, so why don't you talk about what you drew, and maybe we can I'll hold it up to show those of us who are here.
Okay, sure. We talked about learning management systems, and the potential innovation would be finding a new tool, a better tool, to replace Blackboard in the school. And we could definitely relate to the that most of our attention was being, most of my mental space was being spent on those people who are really having trouble with it. So in that regard, with the new LMS, even though we would want to offer new features and better tools, one of the main and shared goals is not to have any disruptions and just have something that's easy and effective. In terms of the middle group, we said that they probably looked like current users who
only had basic needs in terms of the tool. Maybe they're just hosting documents and they just copy the course every quarter and it's the same thing and it fulfills those needs. And so they know how to use it enough to do that and aren't really needing or wanting to add much more. And so in terms of values, it would be maintaining the status quo and having their course continue to run smoothly. But we thought that a possible change agent would be student demand from like course evaluations and things like that, as well as potentially new needs that they may want to incorporate into their course, whether that be for their own interests or in response to student demand or because of everyone else is doing it. And so that might be a potential way to start changing those values.
So in exercise two, what I'm going to challenge you guys to do is to figure out a series of steps and measures that you might take to leverage. So I see you have identified two populations, one who want change, the students. The students always want, give me more technology, I want more tools, I want more toys. And people are just who are happy with the product and don't want to lose that. It seems to me like, in other words, sometimes people say, well, this works. That Excel spreadsheet has worked for me for 40 years. Or the big problem that we faced in student affairs at Stanford was the FileMaker Pro 3 server under somebody's desk. It works, it works. Please don't take it away. FileMaker Pro 3, seriously. All right. So you've got two different populations there who are in the middle. They're not laggards, they're not early adopters. How are you going to leverage them? So in the next part, I'm going to ask you guys to figure out some ways to do that. So how about you guys? Table two.
We did innovation group number 12.
I'll put it up here. Go ahead and talk it out.
Looked at faculty, and I think that the important section here was the shared values. They want to be credible in this innovation. They're really concerned about student success and student engagement. Everybody wants students to become successful, so focusing on that, communicating that, was a really important function of the diffusion of the innovation. I would say that's it in a nutshell.
All right. Anybody else want to add anything? So you've got a broad group of people who are using it. Okay. Table three. Who's going to talk here?
We actually use communication or communicating innovation group 13.
Okay, go ahead.
And basically, like group one, we kind of looked at rolling out a new LMS as our innovation. And our middle group was defined as pretty much the 60% of the faculty base, not our early adopters or innovators and not our laggards, but pretty much the middle meat of everybody else. Their characteristics are they're complacent, the self-directed faculty. Our shared values would be the usefulness of the system, the reliability, support, content migration, and overall success. What they do, they're the main system users, fully online courses to minimal just gradebook usage. They cover a wide range.
So do you hear from them much other than when they have problems? Do you hear about their successes?
We do. Mm-hmm. We probably don't hear as much from their successes as we do when they hit problems. But this group are really the ones that are pretty quiet. You know, they're self-directed. They learn what they need to do to help them successful and however they use the system to present their course.
And so ballpark figure, what percentage of the capability of the system is the average user in the middle of that group using? And just pick that right out of the air. I mean, because you can't be more than 50% wrong.
Yeah, and then, And that's a really hard number to predict. Like I said, we have them, users that use it for fully online courses and some that just use it for posting syllabus and grade books.
Yeah, so you got the whole range.
The whole range.
So, I mean, I think maybe you'd want to look at those just posting syllabi, see if you can move them up the ladder a little bit. So in the next part, we'll challenge you to try and figure out how to leverage that group to open up some further use of the system. Okay, you folks, who's going to talk? And did you have a Google Doc? Is it going to be 14 or 15?
The innovation is an enrollment portal that is based on a degree plan that is active for a student, that is connected to an online class schedule. The first step is for the student to see their current degree plan, to select the course or courses that they want the next semester. The schedule will then array what courses are available that meet that demand, and will place those courses in a matrix for the student. The student will review the matrix in terms of the schedule for the week, days, times, etc. If they accept the schedule, then they will automatically be enrolled in those courses. There are other implications of all of that, of course, that will involve different people, and I'll pass the microphone around to anyone who would want to talk about the next step, which is?
So we saw the middle group as being people in the registrar's office, financial aid group, advisors, and programmers. All of them are not going to be the early adopters or the laggards. And so their characteristics, they're involved in a variety of ways, and some will be resistant. Some will feel more threatened by this than others. Probably the advisors will be the ones who are resistant. Others might be a little more enthusiastic. And then the shared values are student success. We want everyone can't argue with having students be more successful, completing their degrees, retention, and on-time graduation. What do? They enroll students. They oversee financial aid programs. They support databases and make systems work. And our shared doings include getting the students into the correct courses to ensure that success and that graduation and retention. And we see our change agents as being the deans leading from the top, and then the students by demanding something that's going to be useful to them.
Sorry, because we are right in the middle of the exact same thing. And I agree with you on the question of advisors, that there's a varying degree of nervousness, but all of these people are committed to success. Right? They're not committed to failure. They're committed to success. But the advisors are a nervous lot, because they know that there's a tsunami coming, all right? And they are right in the way of it. And so they've got a tool that works. Please don't change up on me. So I'm going to challenge you in the next exercise to figure out what sort of activities and communication strategies can you develop for the advisors? Because then that'll give me something to take home.
So the group from UTSA San Antonio, they actually did the spreadsheet number 21.
21, there we go. So do you want to talk it out, Sherry, or do you want me to?
You might as well.
Okay, so their audience is, can you ask them what their, the thing we don't see here, I guess I didn't put a spot for it, is what is there it is, their supports. No, what I want to see is what is their innovation? Can you guys just type in what is the innovation that you, because their key audience is faculty, tenure track, full time, a whole bunch of different kinds. They're charved values. That's an interesting for an editor. I didn't really spell that particularly well. They're shared values, support student success. I think that's important in universities. We are all in favor of students succeeding. It's a big value that you can, there's nobody out there thinking, oh boy, I'd like to drop that retention rate. Even though it's interesting, retention rate actually costs money. But the fact of the matter is we're all committed to it. Contribute to the strategic mission, create new knowledge. What do they do? Teach and manage, pursue research, publish scientific work. What do they do together? Teach courses for course management, course redesign, copyright intellectual property. But I see that in this case, the leaders, the opinion leaders, are up at the top. And the change agents, only some of them come down into that middle group. So the question I would challenge this group to look at would be, how are you going to leverage the middle of faculty? We all know how easy it is to communicate with faculty. If somebody would provide an answer to that question, I think it could save us all a lot of work. So why don't you talk about how you can leverage some of the middle faculty to become opinion leaders? Because, you know, the provost, that's a really a top-down thing. So I would challenge them in the next exercise to do that. Okay, next group is going to be...
We have Frank using Google Doc 16.
Okay. I need to iterate technology access for undergrads in my institution, and specifically the library, as a way to provide an experience with less friction and less expensive to support. The middle group is the student undergrad population. Technologically competent but not expert at accessing library services. There's an interesting poster today. Does anyone recollect where that was from? I had a good chat with the guy. Was it the University of Western Oregon? We should send out that link, because they have a new knowledge-based system in which they accumulate answers from various different places. So when people answer a question, you answer it in the knowledge base, they collect the answer. So they're basically leveraging their research librarians. Who are the opinion? The early adopters of library services and technology, the youngest ones who cycle in every year with more and more digital nativeness. So how do you capture that experience and propagate it? That would be the question I would ask there. How do you get those young ones who are coming in all enthusiastic and capture their enthusiasm and leverage that to diffuse your innovation? So we were a little, I'm interpreting what has been written by our online folks. Anybody else online with the spreadsheet? All right, so let's go back to exercise two. And if you choose at your group to completely ignore what I'm asking you to do, there will be no penalty. So if you want to do something different to contribute to this discussion, then go ahead and do it. If you want to choose a different problem than the first one you chose, just go ahead and do it. Pick another Google Doc that nobody's used. I can figure out which one it is. But what I've challenged some of you to look at your population, and now how are you going to leverage them? What activities are you going to do? You know, if you were to design a website, how would you design it? Is there an interactive activity? Are you going to have meetings? You're going to give them pizza? You're going to provide iPads? So think out of the box or design your own problem. So let's go to the second exercise. Let's try and do it without clicking on wrong things. And then what I'm going to do as soon as we get going here is I'm going to, diffusion of exercise two, I'll copy that over once we get going here. Here are the questions, strategies. How will you craft information? How will you involve the middle? Reinvention strategies, so it's implemented. How are you going to get people involved in adding? How will you leverage the new opinion leaders? So there you go. And off you go. And you can use this another document. You know, within that Google Drive, you can create your own document, by the way. You've got complete access to do whatever you want inside that Google Drive. Why don't we give them a new piece of paper? That way we can put them side by side. Okay, so are we close to ready? So why don't we start in reverse order here?
Is that on?
Who wants to speak? So go ahead.
So it's interesting because there are three of us that are all on the instructional design side of the house. So, you know, designing a system is something that in the initial exercise is a little foreign to us. So
is that it? 14?
Yes. So one of the things that we decided to do as far as this particular part, how will we craft information? We build a new system based on input from the users which I think is really important, and then let them know that their opinions will be a part of the new process, and also involve them in the crafting of the training materials as well. Because as instructional designers, if you're a good instructional designer, you actually listen to your end users, be able to build your training based upon their input, what they need to know going forward. How will you involve the middle? Have continued input from the users as the system is built, and also have them be a part of the training itself. And I think that it's really important to say that I want to skip down to the last one, and then I'll come back as far as the implementation is concerned. How will you leverage the opinion leaders? I think it's really important. My background is actually in corporate training, and so I believe wholly in the concept of train the trainer, and being able to have your opinion leaders as a part of the training, especially with something like this that would be maybe large scale depending upon your institution. And then that way they could then train the people who would be using the systems. As far as the student side is concerned, because students would need to use the system as well, we have discovered that on-demand training is a really good way to go with most students, that that's what they want to see. As far as reinvention strategies and implementation, rolling out the systems so they can see it in use, I think is really important, and use analytics to see whether the system works to help students complete the programs more successfully and whether it retains and whether it's a good system. So that's basically.
So anybody have any questions? The question I would have is, build a new system based on input from users. How would you collect that input?
I think there are a lot of different ways to be able to do that, whether it's a focus group, whether you reach out to some of the opinion leaders, and also have student involvement as well, from student opinion leaders. But there are a lot of different ways that you can gather that input as you go along.
Would you contemplate putting different populations in the same room? So I'm saying, you said focus on decision makers first, deans, advising leaders, student leaders, like having deans and student users in the same room. Would you contemplate that? Is that useful?
I don't think that any of us would have an issue with doing that, and sometimes that's how you come up with really good ideas, by having divergent populations in the same room talking about the same end result.
Right. And I think that's, to my mind, when you get a leader in the room, I find, especially in staff innovation, that they often want the leader in the room, and whoever the leader may be. They want the leader in the room, and just having the leader in the room gives it, like, this, they're committed to. They're willing to sit through this hour and a half. So, all right, great. Any other thoughts from the table? Okay, do you want to pass the microphone to table number 1, 2, 3? And are you guys number 13 then?
We are number 13.
All right. And exercise 2. There you go. Go ahead.
Right. And for our craft of information, we had a communication campaign, a phased usage approach. We promoted enthusiasm and let users know that their opinions did count. Very similar to what the other table just said, too, that we actually have weekly committee user group meetings, and where they discuss, and we listen to them as far as what we implement in the system and what improvements that we can make. Involving the middle, we were looking at focusing on our heavy users first, and then following up that with our minimal users. Our reinvention strategies included change of policies, new features, new workflows, going out to the users to do training and the like, instead of the users coming to you, and providing some sort of carrot to those that have migrated and are using the new system in some fashion. Leveraging the new opinion leaders, we have them represent each of their respective college and go back and talk to other faculty within their colleges. We do teaching with technology conferences on campus, and we invite a lot of those to present at those conferences. And we have asked them to help focus with the support to other faculty members, and kind of to use Rogers' terms and make them champions, basically.
Any questions? You know, a strategy that we've used successfully, we're working with a company called CollegeNet. Do any of you partner with CollegeNet on a graduate admission system? And they have a product they call Admit. And it really gives a lot of electronic power to the departments. So at Stanford, we collect the information in the middle, but all the decisions are made by the departments in graduate admission. And what we did was we leveraged different people out in department, what we call department land. How about that, us and them? And had them give seminars on how they use the system. And we would get maybe, there's probably 100 administrators who are using this system and hopefully 1,000 or 2,000 faculty. But we would get them, we would get actually, you're talking about sending people to conferences, we'd set up meetings and have somebody else lead the meeting and give the entire presentation. We've had real great success with that. And we've also found out who our natural partners are out there because they volunteer to step up and do that. And it gives them a chance. Some people don't want to stand up in front of an audience, but lots of people actually do. They want to get that opportunity to be recognized. Their boss will see that they got recognized. That's a carrot. It's a real plus-plus. All right, great. Do you want to hand it over to table two? And are you guys group 12?
Yeah, you can bring that up here. And I'm going to turn this over to...
Since it's my project, and I'm actually in the middle of it, and I just came up with a great idea.
Excellent.
This totally, like, yes, it's, like, very cool. So ours is the iPad faculty project. So the way that we crafted information and the way that we disseminated information from this cohort of 96 faculty members who we had given out iPads to is we have a blog where we've made them collect, you know, post materials about their experience. And the one way that we crafted the information was to make them use the categories of teaching, research, or productivity when they did their blog post so that we can filter it by that. So that's really the only thing. We told them we want the bad and the ugly. We want things that don't work, the frustrations that you're having. We want you to really feel safe and comfortable up there. And that we don't know what's going on with these devices either. That's why we're doing this initiative. We called it an initiative, not a program. We called their group a seminar, not a workshop or a training. We're calling them a cohort, you know, our cohort of faculty iPad testers. So there was a big sense of camaraderie about it.
I think they like the word cohort.
Yeah. Well, you know, I stole that from K through 12, but I guess they didn't realize that. I've run out of money. We can't give out any more iPads. I can't negotiate it for it anymore. We've got to pay for edX right now. So but I want to keep it going. I want to keep the community going. So one thing that I was pitching to my team here and asking for advice about was how about opening the blog up to faculty members who have their own iPads, not the ones that the university or the institution have given them, but a lot of them just have them themselves. So I'm thinking faculty, even graduate students, could be asked to go ahead and participate in the blog. They have EIDs, so I can add them as authors if they want to be on the blog and have a post. They can have their own blog post or submit material. And, you know, it's a publishing experience. I'll edit it. We'll peer review it. No. And maybe. And, but we were like, how do we get the word out still even about a blog? You know, even if the best blog isn't always visited, right? So, what's your name? David was talking about events and things, and UT, it's really hard to get people to attend tech-related events. And, you know, so can I piggyback with our other events? But the idea that led me to was, where are they going to go to get these iPads? They're going to go to the campus store, so I can put signage up at the campus store to join the blog. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, at least that's a strategy, right?
Old-fashioned but effective, right?
Yeah, real grassroots.
You go to where they are.
Yeah, so it's like that change bubbling up from the bottom instead of coming from the top down. So thank you all, because that was really exciting for me.
Any questions? Because I have one really big question. I love this line, make taking risks a part of the culture. How did you plan to do that? Because, you know, it's funny, my boss, who's is a big risk taker, is always talking about taking risks. And, you know, I buy in. Most people don't. It's very hard. People think, yeah, you talk about a risk-taking culture, but the reality is I've never been rewarded for a risk that failed. So how would you do that?
I have to give credit to my boss. My boss really sets the tone for everybody in my college, and I wouldn't be doing this project if it wasn't for his good graces And he's a risk taker. And he falls on his face sometimes, but he flat out says, you know, 25% of what you do is going to be fabulous, 50% is going to be okay, and 25% is really going to suck. So his big thing is keeping expectations low. Is you calculate the risks, and you know what you're doing, but you keep everybody's expectation really, really low about what the performance is going to be. That way, when you fail, they don't notice it, you know? So really, it's my boss.
It is an excellent career strategy. You got a good boss. I got to tell you, it sure helped my career. I'll tell you, when we changed registrars, I love the old registrar, in case you know who he is at Stanford. He's a fabulous man, a wonderful person, but he was the registrar who liked things in a box. So I had my box, and my new boss, well, it's 5 years now, opened the box. Okay, let's pass it to table one. And are you guys number 11? Is that right? Oh, you're still on the paper. Okay, you're the paper. All right, so I'm going to hold it up again. Go ahead and tell us what you think.
Yeah, we talked a lot about pilot testing as a strategy, and we talked a lot about how to incentivize people to pilot test. And one approach was a buddy system where faculty or users in close proximity and who have a good relationship with each other can pilot together so that they're, you know, learning together and helping each other out. Also providing extra support, providing recognition and visibility after the fact, turning them into mad scientists by granting them, you know, if they pilot test, then and they want certain additional features, and make those happen. Make it look like what they want it to be.
In other words, what you're saying is that the people who pilot and do that stuff also get to be involved in, I hate the word, but focus groups or use cases, right?
Right. One thing that came up at the very last minute that we didn't really get to answer is what to do if the pilot tests fail, if it's not effective, because obviously you can't just go forward and say we're going to use this anyways. So we didn't come up with optimal solutions for that approach.
I've got to say, okay, anybody have any questions? Something I do all the time, and last summer we rolled out a new software for producing the course catalog. And again, as I say, I mostly deal with staff and faculty. We've tried to get faculty to use it, but they still actually, they were very unhappy because we can no longer produce a Word document for them. What they can do is click on a single link and open a document that looks just like a Word document and change it. But that's not a Word document. So we had a little trouble there. But I found that as we were implementing it and we had problems, I just said, this is an implementation. And I try and educate my users that what implementation is like. I want to educate people that I'm dealing with that implementation is about discovering bugs. So when you find one, feel good. Like what I tell my mother about dog hair. If instead of vacuuming it, just say dog hair, good. It's the same thing with bugs. Bugs, good. I found a bug. Look at me. So I think that's an important thing. I mean, if there's a total failure and the system doesn't work, but you're going to find bugs. And so if you pre-prepare people for the fact that finding a bug makes you a part of the team. Yeah. All right, folks, let's look quickly at our online folks. What numbers do we have? We had, do you recollect? All right, let's go to spreadsheet 21. And did you guys go to the strategy part? And I guess I didn't mention that. I had a second one. So they haven't added anything there. So we'll go back to 16. On exercise 2. How we small, easy to absorb snippets. That is important. People listen to a certain amount. And 30-second guides, elevator speeches, reach out to users, involve more of the campus, talk to other service providers. Social media, we didn't talk at all today about how to use social media. That's an entirely different question. It kind of depends on what social media they use. It always seems to me like it's a secondary strategy rather than a primary one. Reinvention strategies, easy to reinvent because they can't do it the old way. Organizational changes, forcing cultural changes. And how you leverage assessment, marketing, create a relationship with the average students, entire tenure at the university. Assessment is obviously really important. Publishing assessment is even more important. And even when the news is bad, publishing assessment, I think, is really important because it gets people involved in the conversation. Let's look at, what was the other one, 17? No. Oh, no, part two, I think I did that, did I? No. We looked at 16, right? All right, we'll try one more. No, there we go. Oh, wait a second, how are you craft information? No, it's engage faculty to come to our faculty commons by coordinating events with free food. It goes a long way. The only way we can get students to student focus groups, it's pizza. 8 o'clock in the morning, pizza. Reorganizing team roles within the library, analysis of the use of the space, listening to our faculty about their needs, creating new partnerships with other units on campus. Listening to faculty isn't enough. You have to be seen to be listening. What is the line? It's not good enough to be good. You have to be seen to be good. And I think especially that's true with faculty. You have to be seen to be good. So we've got 5 minutes. This has been an experiment. I hope it worked for you. Does anybody have any feedback, anything you want to say on the question of diffusion of innovation? If there's any message I want to send out there, it's that main message about remember the middle. The truth is generally in the middle. And that's not just because I'm about to turn 60 that I'm saying that. You know, if I had thought at the age of 20 that I would say that, I don't know what I would have done. So for those of you who are young, ultimately you will come to understand that the truth is in the middle, but the truth is in the middle. Those are the people who are going to carry you forward. So I want to thank you very much for participating. I hope this worked for you. It was a fascinating exercise for me. Thank you.
Again, please remember to go online and submit feedback on the session.
Oh, and by the way, if any of you want to carry on this conversation, my email is, it's on that webpage, arod@stanford.edu. I'd love to hear your thoughts or anything that comes up in the diffusion of innovation field. Just feel free to email me anytime. I'm always interested in the conversation. I got a bunch of business cards here, too.